If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done. Hello and welcome to the Get Stuff Done podcast. I am today once again joined by a fantastic guest from Romania. My first Romanian guest, his name is Magor Sibi. And he is somebody that I had the great fortune of meeting when he was working here in Korea a number of years ago. He is currently a partner of the Trend Consult Group, which has been going through phenomenal growth in the last few years. But Magor has a very interesting and eclectic career path so far, which I would like to delve into today. Originally, he was in the political sphere, in that area for a number of years before moving into the NGO space, where he worked for WWF for a number of years in more than a couple of countries. He's now working, as I mentioned, at Trend Consult Group, and I think that we have a lot to cover today, so let's get right to it. Magor, thanks for being my guest today.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy that I was able to come.
And also, I want to thank you, even though your throat's not feeling so perfect today, for still making the time to be with us.
But
today,
my voice is deeper, and this creates the illusion. This is actually scientifically proven that if your voice is deeper, people tend to give you more credit, think that you are more competent than you are. So I might benefit from this discussion.
That's a good thing to note. And I think to my podcast producer, let's turn my tone down on the editing so that we can reach more people. But thanks very much for being with us. And tell me a little bit about your journey, because you have been absolutely, you know, this podcast is called the Get Stuff Done podcast. And it's clear that you are somebody who both enjoys getting stuff done very much so. And I think we share a lot of that similar mentality, but you also seem to be very good at doing it. So I'm going to jump in with the very first question that I ask all my guests is, what is it that drives you to get?
This is very good that I manage to get stuff done, but sometimes I do stuff done before I think. So I have a duality here, but in general, I'm very motivated by the impact. Okay. This is what drives me. This is what defines me. So it's impossible for me to be in organizations where the vision and the mission of the organization is not very aligned with what am I thinking or what am I feeling. And in general, you know, people think that careers and development, it's about power and growth and sometimes money. But I really feel that when you create connections and when you feel that others are growing around you, it doesn't matter if they are colleagues or friends or clients. I do think that you get the next level of gratification and the next level of satisfaction. Because as Harvard is saying as well, the only way of being happy and balanced with our life is through our connections. It's not through our achievements.
That's interesting to hear that. I am 100% proponent of that perspective. So in that regard, then, how have you throughout your career built those connections? What is it that you do to make sure that your connections are as valuable as they can be?
This wasn't my vision all the time. This wasn't the way I was working all the time. Actually, Korea was the changing point in my career when I needed to go from totally rational thinking, totally result-oriented thinking towards connections. Because, you know, before then, it was very easy. And in general, it's relatively easy if you are a very driven and sometimes obsessed guy to deliver some results, no matter the industry, no matter the place, no matter whatever. But when you come to a country like Korea, where you don't understand the language, don't know the culture, don't know the people, you cannot interpret even the most basic behaviors, you are doomed to fail. And the guy who never failed in his life to live a failure during his mandate in Korea, you know, to see that I'm helpless and I'm not able to create an impact and I'm not able to come up with a strategy. Because in general, I thought that the role of the leader in an organization is always think, and create the strategy. And you are the only brain in the organization and everybody else is executing. But this wasn't possible in Korea. I did not understand the titles, how we are sitting in an office. I did not understand the basic interactions. I did not understand the market. I didn't know the language. So I entered a period of quite deep burnout and maybe also a bit of depression. And one morning, you know, when I had my fifth night without sleeping, I told to myself, if I want to survive my mandate here in Korea, I need to change something. And then I started to focus much more on connections, on people. And this was very rewarding because what I knew that, but I somehow ignored it. Korea is filled with very talented, very creative, amazing people. And if you create for them a bit of space in order to create, they will do wonders. So for the first time in my life, I was not the performer. I was not the guy who was creating the results and taking all the credits and so on. But the people in my team started to generate some results for what I didn't even know that I'm connected with that. And actually, I was slightly connected because it was totally their work, their ideas, their results.
Right.
And I do think that when you look at this way of approaching leadership, you discover that your effort as a leader is much lower. You discover that the level of stress is getting much lower. And, you know, when I had my last days in the office, I remember a part of my team came to me at my desk and they offered me a Korean stamp and so on and so on. I was not prepared, you know, but to show feelings before them. But I went out to the bathroom and I cried a little bit because I felt so touched. And I felt that genuine connection was created there. And even if you ask me, you know, how my colleagues are, most of my colleagues I'm still talking with. I gave them recommendation letter. I'm interested in their lives. Because I feel if you are able to create a real team at some point of your life, they will always be your team somehow. And I'm not saying that your team as you are the leader and they are your team. They will get your back at some point in your life. And I will try to get their backs at some point in their life. So I learned a lot and I discovered that through connections, leadership generates much better results.
It really sounds like that was a significant turning point for you. And I'm really glad that you did experience that, but importantly that you had the self-awareness to make that change.
But it wasn't something conscious. I was so low, I did not have any option but to change. I always knew that there are other ways of leading people. I always knew that you can have connections. I always knew that results can be generated in different ways. But somehow I was so afraid. I said, I have my way of getting the results. Until it's working, I'm getting the results. And especially if you are an expat, it's very hard to think about connections because you are for a determined amount of time. So connections in general will not yield rewards. Results will yield rewards. And this was also very hard for me being in Seoul to create connections and see the friends and people I connected with leave. So some went back to Hong Kong, some went back to UK, some went back to the US. And it was hurtful every time, you know, because when you invest in a relation, You don't want to end. But this is the life of the of an expat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're right. Many people have come to Korea and failed. And it's often with that short-term period that's given to them, you know, on the face of it, it doesn't make sense to invest heavily in relationships. And that's mutual, I think. I see that with local Korean organizations with regards to foreign management and vice versa. But I think it seems like now beyond Korea that it has influenced your entire leadership style. Is that?
Actually, I came back into consultancy because I realized how wrong I was doing leadership in my career before Korea. And I know how much suffering I had during my time in general in leadership, although the results were there, although I was always receiving a lot of appreciation, a lot of appraisal, and I was having a very positive image. Mm-hmm. Inside, it was very, very hard because I always felt the pressure. I always felt the lack of connection. I always felt that, yes, I'm delivering the results, but sometimes I'm hurting people. You know, this is funny because back then, I actually knew all my numbers for all my years. So if you ask me, I don't know, in 2009, what were the numbers and what was the overachievement and so on, I could tell you. But I had no idea how my people felt and thought and so on. Right now, I remember when a colleague, and I had colleagues who had sleepless nights because of my ways of doing things. And I had, in the same period, sleepless nights because of the same thing. So sometimes, you know, we are saying that we are responsible for the relationships. Yes, but if you are a leader, you are a bit more responsible because you have a bit more leverage. You have a bit more authority. So if you are a jerk and the other guy is a jerk, you are the one who could stop it. Your behavior is the first that should be changing, and only after that you should be expecting that others to change. In general, in organization, when we enter, we look for the safety. You know, what is the staple for safetiness? It's the leader's behavior. If you copy the leader's behavior, in general, you should be safe. So if everybody is acting in an unacceptable way in the organization, I tend not to look at the people. I tend to look at myself and to ask myself, am I acting in that way? Am I enabling in any way that type of behavior? Am I encouraging it? And then, you know, I can have the answer of maybe I'm not doing things right. But anyway, if we are looking at any kind of team, the first who should be putting the questions and giving himself a bit of self-reflection is the leader. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a very famous leadership reference, A Bug's Life, mm-hmm. which is saying, if you are the leader, it's your fault.
That's it. Yep. And now, Margot, you've been involved in very different sectors in your career, right? Not a lot of people have that kind of diversity. Maybe they want to, but cannot, or tried and not able to. What would you say have been your main takeaways from each of those sectors in terms of if you could essentially kind of fuse the best of all of them together? Because I know that each one has its kind of plus points and negative points.
I think that we have the impression that teams are different. We are saying in NGO or in university or in politics or in the army or in, we are behaving differently. And that's not true. So if you realize that you are working with people and you accept that you are working with people, no matter which is the field you are working in, some behaviors will be always valid. For instance, seeing your people, listening to your people, appreciate your people, generate safety in your organization, no matter what kind of organization is, will generate performance. because you know I hear a lot of time that no, we are a bit special in our industry. We cannot be empathetic and
right,
we cannot
right,
be
right.
caring and so on and so on. And the funny thing, I wrote a book with one of my close friends who was an army surgeon major for 16 years, a professional soldier, comparing military leadership with civil or corporate leadership. And what I discovered that the amount of empathy, the amount of listening, the amount of decentralization, the amount of empowering the people on the basis of the pyramid is much, much higher in the army than in any kind of modern organization, because the interdependence is so big that you need to make sure that in any given moment you are taking the best decisions. And they realized if you want to take the best decisions, in the decision everybody should participate. We are not doing that in general in corporations. In corporation, there is a thinking layer. Mm-hmm. We are calling it, I don't know, board or executive committee or whatever. And there is an execution layer. And the middle management is somehow balancing between the leaders and the people, putting pressure on the people and try to please people above.
Yeah.
And that's very unhelpful. It's very not really working as I see in the organization. This is why we have a global average of 20% when we are talking about engagement. What does that mean? From 10 people, only 2 are going with enthusiasm in the morning to work. How can we generate performance when only 2 people out of 10 want to create value?
Sure.
And also 2 persons want to create some damage in the organization. So if we are seeing like this, the high performers are balanced by the low performers and we are playing with the survivors. Why do we have 70% survivors in our organizations? Why? Can we raise the enthusiasm in the organization? Can we raise the connection? Yes, we can. But how? Look at the people. When we try to transform people into resources, we will have a lot of negative feedback because people never behave like resources. Even me, myself, I had a very well-thought agenda for today, what I need to do. But my throat is acting up and what I can deliver because I'm not a resource, it's always smaller that I plan to deliver. It's the same in organization. If you have 100 people, you can imagine not 100 of them will deliver what you are expecting. And this means you always juggling with this, you always managing this, and you always look at people, because if people are comfortable, your clients will be comfortable. If people feel that you are looking after them, they will look after your clients. They will look after your business. But if you treat people badly, you cannot accept that they will give you loyalty or high performance or whatever else, or kindness to the client. Mm.
I think that's a very good take on it. And other experts in the field have talked about how some of the areas of the armed forces and military do absolutely represent the elite of kind of team management and leadership, and I think it's a lot of what you identified there, and I also like the way you drew the thread across the fact that doesn't matter the industry. We're all people in teams that act in certain ways. But I want to kind of understand what really is driving you. What is it that makes you so ambitious and so determined? It's clear you have a very high output, always wanting to do as much as possible. Have you always had that from a young age? Can you pinpoint a time at which it kind of developed? Tell me a bit.
I was always being very driven because I understood if you want performance, you need to be a bit obsessed. And no matter what am I doing, if I'm doing running, if I'm doing CrossFit, if I'm doing working, if I'm doing studying, I tend to be obsessive until I reach a certain amount of level, where I see myself or where I envision myself. And this is good and bad, because this is what I define perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I obsess about things which have zero relevance in general in my life. For instance, I invested a lot of time and a lot of suffering in my running, but I could have done the same with much more ease and much more relaxation and much more enjoyment, and probably would have been much better for my health and much better in general enjoyment level of my life. For instance, when I was in Korea, I had a period when I was running 100 or 120 kilometers per week. Because this is how I try to balance myself. I said, I'm consuming myself so much at work. This is how I let my tension go. So, there was a part in my life when I was delivering the results because I felt a big hole inside me. So I felt that I'm not valuable. I felt that I'm not lovable. I felt that I do not deserve appreciation. And in my head, it was, if I have absolutely remarkable results, probably I will receive appreciation. Probably people will see me for who I am and so on and so on. But this doesn't happen in life. Results do not generate connections. Connection generate results, but not the other way. So for instance, when I entered the European Parliament, back at that time, I was in the record books of the European Parliament because, you know, at 27 a year old, nobody entered the European Parliament. So the next youngest was at, I don't know, 39 or something like that. So it was a huge gap. If I was forgetting my badge at home, they did not let me into the parliament because nobody believed me that I'm a member of the parliament. So,
brilliant.
But again, I expected that being, you know, a high level dignitary and, you know, vice president of the EU-India collaboration and vice president of the environmental committee and so on, it will bring me self-appreciation. And it didn't. Because I have seen the other pikes and other heights where I could be, and I wasn't there. So, you know, if you would have asked me at 29 if I'm prepared to become a minister in Romania's government, I would have said I'm the most prepared guy and I'm the only one who can deliver and so on and so on. When I actually received this question much later in my career,
yes,
I felt the most unprepared guy.
Okay.
And I knew much more than I knew years before. So the whole idea is if you do not feel doubt, it means that you are too afraid and you are not allowing yourself to see your weak points, or you are totally unaware.
Right.
Probably I was both. So a big part of my career, you know, I was having the drive and the obsession which brought me the results, but nothing else.
Right.
And I had expectations from the results. I was not driving for the results. I was driving for what the results might get me. Appreciation, connection, so on. And it didn't come. Right now, what drives me, it's a different thing. It's the impact.
Okay.
You know, people who write me on LinkedIn every day, you know, with their own stories and ideas and so on. Mm-hmm. When I go to a client, and it happened to me, you know, that I was working with the executive committee of a very big company, and somebody from the basis of the organization told me, I don't know what you are doing there, but I feel changes in my organization. And when you hear things like that, it's about making life better. And the best thing about it, that, you know, when I was driving for the most shiny results in my life, I was alone. You know, in politics, I consider that I'm alone against everybody. In entrepreneurship, I consider that I'm alone against everybody and I'm an outlier and so on. Now I don't want to be an outlier.
Okay.
Now I'm perfectly happy to be part of a team. And this is actually my first job, mm-hmm. which was not CEO or leader in the organization. So I took this job without actually knowing what am I going to do. And it took me like 2 years, 2 years and a half just to figure out in general, what can I do in this organization?
Okay.
But we have a CEO mm-hmm. and I respect him very much. He's a great CEO. We have partners And I'm just one of the guys. I'm not the guy. And this is great because I can be happy for my colleagues' successes. I can let them to be happy for my successes. And this brings me a new dimension in my life, which was never present when I was driving alone for the biggest height of success.
Yeah, it does get talked about a lot that there is a relatively high level of loneliness among C-level executives because I don't think it has to be that way, but I think it just has gone that way and developed over many decades to be like that. And I think what you're really kind of highlighting is that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I mean, I think that is literally
absolutely
what you're saying.
And here there is another interesting thing, because I talked about my career in Korea. In Korea, I had another tribe. I almost consider them a small family for me back then. It was the Seoul Flyers, which is a running group in Seoul. Yep.
I have some friends.
I build up my persona very carefully. Uh-huh. In Romania, I had a public image very carefully built up. And, you know, it was not necessarily about who I am. It was about who I want to be. And I was always careful to show my aspirational face to anyone. Seoul Flyers was the first group in my life where nobody knew who I was. Not even my real name. I did not say about me Magor. I said Mo. I said everybody my name is Mo because it's simpler to use and so on and so on. They had no idea about my career. They had no idea about my functions. They had no idea. You know, I was just one of the guys. And that was so great, you know, because at the end of the day, when Joseph or Toby or one of the guys said, let's hang out, let's have a beer and so on, I knew that it's because of me. It's not because of my achievements. It's not because of my functions. It's because we are just guys having a dream. And that's I cannot express what does that mean, you know, inside.
Yeah. No, it's I'm actually really glad that you mentioned tribes, because I just put a piece on LinkedIn this week about the so-called third place. This idea that we have our self-made home, the first place, the second place is work, structured social interaction. But as humans, we need a third place, a place that we choose to be whatever kind of group or interaction or community or tribe, as you said, that you need. And it can be many different things. For you, it was a running club. And so that definitely, I think, maybe in this increasingly digitalized world, we have that it comes to us less easily, and we have to be even more conscious to try to find those places, those communities, to kind of fill that gap and make sure that we have that in our lives, to be able to have that kind of meaningful social interaction, communication, like you said, not because of title, organization, authority, or anything else, but simply as a person. So tell me now a little bit more about the work you're doing at Trend Consult and the types of projects that you're working on and how you're helping some of your...
So I'm leading the organizational culture and leadership departments. Basically, my personal opinion is that we are talking about organizational culture just because we don't want to put all the pressure on the leader. But in general, when we are entering a big project in order to change the behaviors in the organization, the biggest part of the project, it's about changing the behaviors of the leadership team. Mm-hmm. You know, look at it. How much clarity is it? You know, again, I go back to Gallup. Gallup is saying, if you are asking people, how clear is to you what is expected of you at your workplace? Only 48% of the people are saying it is clear. It means that more than half of the people who are working in different corporations, organizations, NGOs, and so on, they have no clue what is expected of them. And this is generating a lot of stress, because there is no higher stressor for a human being than ambiguity. Sure. Because no matter what you are doing every day, you are always checking for feedback. You are always trying to figure it out. Is it okay? Is it not okay? And this consumes a lot of energy. So I do think if nothing else, then executive committees and company boards are creating a bit more clarity, the stress level in the organization already goes down. And you know, many times I hear organizations talking only about results and numbers and profit. I do not buy it. No organization or very few organizations was founded solely on money. Very few organizations said, let's invent something which bring us a lot of money. Generally, the people who founded the organization had some dreams. And we don't speak about the dreams. You know, I'm talking with an agri organization and I'm saying to them, you are not about selling machines. You are about changing the way people are thinking about agriculture, because this could save our future. If people are not doing the intensive, the very destroying agriculture and using more modern tools and so on, we might have something to eat in the future. Or I'm talking about, you know, healthcare organization. I'm selling, you know, I was at an organization who is making seat belts and airbags for all the companies in the world. So all the car companies. Mm-hmm. And I went into the factory and I asked the guy at the factory assembly line, what you are doing? And he looked at me and he said, saving lives. This is dreaming. This is about, you know, and sometimes in the organizations, we are very afraid because we leaders, it's not that we are badly intentioned, but the whole idea when we were promoted, nobody told us what this job is about. Most of the leaders on the market are self-taught. And they did it the hard way. And they are very afraid. You know, they always second guess themselves. They always question themselves. So they are afraid if I show a bit of weakness, everything will go haywire. And this is not the case. This is not the case. You know, when I went, and in Korea, you know, a highly hierarchical and competitive society, when I told the people around me that I'm not able to carry my weight, they did not told me, okay, get out. We will get a better guy. They ask me, how can we help? My colleagues ask me, how can we help to ease your pain? Yeah. But they had their own pains. So just the fear. And I do think that leadership, a very big part of leadership, it's about overcoming the fear. Let yourself be seen a little bit. Let express our true self a little bit.
Yeah.
Because authenticity doesn't mean that we are always aspirational. I'm not just authentic when I'm giving nice speeches. You know, half of the things I'm telling to you, I have a hard time applying in my own life. But that makes me authentic, you know. And this is authenticity. It's not about perfection. It's not about delivering. It's about building on our real capabilities and potential and not what we imagine that we could do. Because otherwise, we will be always in balance.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think definitely something around organizations is, you know, almost mandated by the schedule, right? The quarter end, the half year end, whatever that next target is. And it's always just driving to that without just sitting down, taking a step back and actually like looking at how things are actually going. And really addressing the more long term issues to actually kind of make a change, and I think a lot of people have very much fixed identities in their different parts of their life, right? A very separate private self, maybe a very different work self, maybe if they are a member of other organizations or other groups, and they have another identity, and often they're very separate and almost very different. And I think we should also try to make those identities more intertwined. And that comes down to authenticity, right? Which is what you mentioned. I think if we can be more of our real true self, rather than putting on a show, a character to play a role, then we will maybe have better connections. We probably will be more engaged. We will probably be able to have more meaningful relationships. And I think that will definitely be a good thing. I know that you've expanded beyond your business role into also helping people with education. I know that you've got involved in a lot of organizations outside of work with regards to education. What's the latest?
I'm in two EMBA programs. I'm teaching, but I'm also teaching at university level. So we have an entrepreneurship university, which means that you are not studying theoretics, but when you finish the university, you need to have a working company of your own in order to be able to be an entrepreneur. And this is very interesting. And now I started to look into pre-graduate education, you know, to look a bit in the school. I will go to the British school in order to develop a bit about entrepreneurship, talk about the guys. You know, you can never start in time. And especially this is the most important, you know, the hook for me or the anchor for what am I doing. It's never about the money. Even the people who are saying that I want to have a lot of money, you don't want the money. You want what the money will bring you. And the money you are visualizing that it will bring you appreciation or respect or whatever else. So I always tend to encourage people to look deeper into what you are actually looking for, because this way you might be able to create some sturdier and healthier constructions. Because sometimes, you know, we spend half of our time building projects which we don't even believe in. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
It almost sounds funny, and I guess that's why I laughed when you said it. But it's unfortunately true. A lot of
but look at me. You know, I never looked at job advertisement below CEO level, but I hated to be a CEO. I still don't like to be a CEO because there are a lot of aspects when you are a CEO, like financials, like all the administrative, like the projections, and so on, which I cannot do. Even if at my best, I will do this at the mediocre level. So why am I forcing myself to do something? Because I like free letters. Free letters made a big part of my life to be much more unpleasant than it could have been. Now I'm looking at myself and looking at my CEO and saying, why would anyone want to be a CEO? It's a lot of responsibility. It's a lot of hassle. It's a lot of pain. Why?
Yes, and sitting here as the CEO of my own company, I can very much understand the true meaning of that. There is no doubt. Where do you get all your energy from, Margot? You seem to, you know, do you have a special diet? Well, is it something you mentioned? You're running. I don't know whether you're still running a lot. What is it that gives you?
I do a lot of sports, but I started to notice myself, because what I see, for instance, when you, in general, humans go in front of large audiences, we tend to give energy, not to take energy. Very few people are fortunate enough to go into the room and leave the whole room exhausted, and they come out with a lot of energy. I give a lot of energy. So what I discovered looking at most of my behaviors is that if I go in a very small group, like in a mastermind group, or if I go, you know, a very small team coaching and so on, no matter how tired I go there, I come out with more energy I entered. So I recently discovered that interactions are generating a lot of energy to me. And this is about feeling that other people have same struggles than you, feeling that other people have same thoughts than you, feeling that other people can understand and can hear you. You know, we live in a society when everybody wants to talk, nobody wants to listen. When you create groups for you where there is true listening and curious listening, and people look at you, look at who you are, the quality of life changes. And I do think this is invaluable. Very few people can say that, you know, my relationships are fueling me, my relationships. And, you know, even here, I need to make a small disclaimer. For me, career is very easy. It was always been very easy. It's very easy to get any kind of achievement. Doesn't matter if I'm driven by delusions or I'm driven by connections. For me, it's much harder to build a personal life. And now I realize that, okay, a lot of years passed. Maybe I should invest in that part of my life as well, because otherwise I will have only one leg of the chair. You know, as you said, you have the work, you have the free time, you have the third, and you also have the time with yourself. If you are not able to have some quality time with yourself, maybe there's something worth looking into.
I want to ask you a little bit about language and how, perhaps we start with how you are, you realize that you are different depending on what language you're using. Because you mentioned when you came to Korea, you of course didn't understand anything. It was like a totally different paradigm. But of course also English is not your first language. You speak several languages. So tell me a little bit about how you perceive yourself in different...
For me, it was very hard because in Romania, I'm from the Hungarian minority. So as I said, for me, it was very hard to learn Romanian. But after I learned Romanian, I learned not just how to speak Romanian, but how to think in Romanian. And now, for instance, when I'm talking in English, I'm thinking in English. I'm not translating. I don't have any kind of intermediary thinking. And this is very helpful. And also what I loved in Korea, how the language is built is telling a lot about the culture. And I love the possession pronoun is not present in the Korean language. It was very shocking for me that I couldn't tell my house, Najib. I said, Uri Chibe, which is right. Our house. And I was, how can it be our house? I'm the only one living there. But the whole idea is that the community is always before the individual. I think delivers the real essence how Korea was able to do this leap, quantum jump in the last 50 years, because they understood that it's important, the individual, but it's more important, the community and the legacy. And many people are thinking about legacies, and very few people around me in my country, in the society, are thinking about legacies. Everybody thinks that life is about getting through life, not about what we are leaving behind. And languages teach you without anything. Now I'm learning Spanish. I can already speak a bit of Spanish, and you get to know a lot of traditions, a lot of ideas, a lot of structure, and you are not learning a language. You are learning a way of living.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and you've illustrated that perfectly with such a good example from the Korean, and that intrinsic bond between the language and the culture, I think, is what makes it so interesting to speak different languages. And so you had been overseas for a number of years, and you then returned back to your country. How was that? Did you experience any difficulties in doing so?
I always expected that coming to Korea will be the hardest and going back it will be very easy. It was the other way. Because of the people and because what happened in Korea, I was very well received and it was a relatively smooth landing. After that, it got hard. But coming back to Romania was very different because, you know, when you are living in a country, when the rules are respected, when some concepts like taking other people's stuff does not exist and so on and so on, it's very hard to readapt because I do not understand. It was very hard to understand the traffic in Korea. Everything was so nice. And if you took a bus, you always were on time and so on. In my country, it's a bit different. The traffic is different. The behaviors are different. And you certainly cannot leave your wallet in the
coffee shop,
in the restaurant, because you will not find it.
Yeah, ever. So it seems that there is just a constant journey, a constant learning that we must forever do in our lives. And it feels like it's never ending. It feels like, you know, we must keep doing that to be able to, you know, appreciate what we have, but also to get fulfillment from what it is that we're doing. Another question that I am, and I know that we're running out of time now, but I want to just ask you finally about, in terms of transferable skills, which is something that we talk about on the Get Stuff Done podcast, since you are, of course, going into companies and seeing how they are operating and trying to help them to improve, what would you say is the ultimate most important transferable skill that people need, and if they don't have it, that they should be looking to do?
Listening. I do think that if there is one skill which should be taught to everybody, no matter what are you working in a company, is listening. And listening, I recently found out that listening does not mean that you can talk in front of me and I will not contradict you. It means if you give me some suggestions, I will take them into consideration. So if you are sitting next to me and every week you give me a lot of suggestions and I don't implement any of them, it means I'm not actually listening. So listening, it's about being there for the other, being available, and being willing to change. And that is very, very rare.
I think that's a great moment to finish. I feel like we have so much more that we could cover, so I think I will definitely look to have you back again, Magura. Thank you so much for being a guest today and sharing some of your insights and experiences.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to everybody for listening and watching this episode. It's been absolutely great to go through some of the key points with Magur and the experiences that he's had across different countries and the journey of which we are all on in some way or another. Thank you for being a part of it. I do hope you will subscribe so that you can keep getting every episode that we put out going forward. And on that note, let's get stuff done. Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out. Or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.